Russia's illegal war of aggression against Ukraine has shattered the peace in Europe. NATO's strategic doctrine states that Russia is the most significant and direct threat to Euro-Atlantic security, peace and stability. It's clear Russia wants to establish spheres of influence and control other countries through coercion, subversion, aggression and annexation. We can now see clearly that Russia uses conventional cyber and hybrid means, including disinformation against NATO, allies and partners. NATO says that it does not seek confrontation and poses no threat to Russia, but that may be part of the problem. Russia commits crimes on this scale because no one, apart from Ukraine, has shown the will to stop them or pose a significant threat to Russia's ambitions or Putin's regime. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like and subscribe to see more great speakers that we feature on the channel. Do also comment on the videos and check out the validated Ukrainian charities that are listed in the description of the video. Sten Rinning is director of the Danish Institute for Advanced Study. Formerly, he was vice dean for research at the Faculty of Business and Social Sciences at the University of Southern Denmark. He was also a member of the Alfen Group and a non-resident associate fellow at the NATO Defence College. Among the topics he works on are NATO, European security, and war studies. Sten, welcome to the channel.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
We'll also mention and put a link to your book about NATO, which, of course, has come out very much aligned with the 75th anniversary of the founding of the NATO alliance. And before we dive into the current challenges that NATO is facing, please tell me, you know, why the book, why now, and why is it significant that the NATO alliance has lasted for, you know, so long? And can we rate it as success to date?
Well, NATO sticking around for 75 years is a success for a political military alliance. And it is of such impact on our lives, we who live under the NATO umbrella, if you will, but also NATO's impact on world politics is significant. And I thought it was timely to take stock of the full 75 years. Why did this alliance come about? How does its historical legacy shape its activities today? And what can we expect to come next?
And of course, when NATO was born, it was an era of significant threat, a significant threat of Russian or Soviet ambition to push further into Europe and continually challenge the West. So how did the alliance come about, and what was its early vision in terms of countering the threat from the Soviet Union?
Well, there were really two threats when seen from North America. And I should probably start by saying that the alliance was in many ways at the invitation of European leaders, Western European leaders. They saw that they were too weak, too incoherent to defend themselves against the emerging Cold War, the confrontation with the Soviet Union, and they wanted the U.S. to help them safeguard themselves. But from the Americans' perspective, and this is really important, when they started coming around to the idea that, yes, perhaps they should have an overseas engagement, they saw two threats. One, of course, was the Soviet Union that could install communist regimes in all of Europe and thus close off Europe from the United States. But the other threat was Europe's return to what Europe had always done, which was balance of power politics. And in the American outlook, balance of power politics was sure to produce only one thing, and that was more conflict. And so moving in to keep the Soviet Union out, they also demanded that the Western Europeans had to transform their political relations. They had to move beyond balance of power politics and form a community that would not get the United States in trouble if they engaged.
And that balance of power politics, so what's the transformation that was required there? I assume institutions like the European Union are part of that, you know, to focus on sort of trade and alliances that prevent tussles over borders and sovereignty and so on. That seems to have held pretty well. How was it created and how did it work?
Well, the European Union, you're quite right that that is one of the major effects of this American approach to Europe. But the European Union, or the European communities at the time, became the answer only in the mid to late 1950s. So for about, a small decade, the United States and the Europeans, they were looking for answers to this. So what does this American desire for Europe's transformation, what did that mean? And in a European perspective, who was going to hold the baby? Who was actually going to be responsible for transforming these relations? And everyone thought that it was the neighbor that had to do it. And the key thing was really defense forces. For a while, the United States wanted France to take charge of this and form a European defense community with West Germany. But when that failed, they pulled West Germany into NATO, and it became clear then that defense was not where Europe's transformation was going to begin. It had to be economic. One of the things that conditioned this approach that Europe has had to transform first and foremost economically was the American response to the Korean War of 1950. Which militarized NATO. There was a sense of threat in Europe that if it could happen in Korea, it could happen in Europe too. And so the buildup of the alliance led to an American military investment in NATO that created an enduring burden-sharing agenda in NATO. If the Americans are doing all this, shouldn't the Europeans be doing more? That's one question. And if the Americans are doing this, shouldn't the Europeans then focus on other things? And that led them into this economic track of transformation.
This burden sharing is an interesting issue, isn't it? We'll come on to Trump and the threat to NATO and the US role, I guess, later. But has the burden sharing always been on an unequal basis, or has it really accelerated in the 90s after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the so-called, the naivety perhaps of turning swords into plowshares and the deinvestment and downsizing of militaries across Europe in that period?
Well, burden sharing has taken different shapes and forms depending on where the alliance has been. And through much of the Cold War, the United States wanted a burden sharing arrangement whereby they would do the big weapons, the big nuclear weapons, and the Europeans should focus more on conventional forces that would sort of be on the first ladders of escalation. To many Europeans, that this was insufficient because then they would just be doing the dishes, and the U.S. would get to call all the big shots. But that was built into it, and the drama in NATO then became: how do we consult effectively given this division of responsibilities? In the 90s, it became a little bit easier because the good times were rolling. The Soviet Union had become Russia. We could trust Russia. We could work with Russia. This became difficult through the 1990s, though, because of crisis management outside of NATO's area, out of area, it was called. First in Bosnia Herzegovina, Croatia, then later Kosovo. The Europeans wanted to take the lead, and the US was willing to let them take the lead, but they were poorly equipped and politically in disagreement. And so again, that started a crisis management, burden sharing drama that in many ways went on steroids with the war on terror, because then crisis management moved to Afghanistan, and Europe was never quite able to deliver on a shared burden in Afghanistan. And now we're back to Europe, we're back to confrontation with Russia, and here we go again.
And before we head into the sort of quagmire of conversation that is Ukraine and vis-a-vis NATO, can we just rewind back to the Cold War period? Because it does seem that NATO was able to provide an effective deterrent. Russia obviously tested the alliance in a variety of ways, but not through direct military incursion in Europe. It didn't seek to, after the attempt to take over Berlin was repulsed, it didn't seek to use overtly vital means to do that again. In that respect, what about NATO actually worked? What was it about the capabilities and the will to use them that was able to deter Russia for several decades?
Well, it was always this combination of military means and political ends, and creating a theory of coherence amongst the two. So how the military means could support NATO's political ends, that was always the fraught question in NATO. Should it be by the threat of massive nuclear retaliation? Should it be by the threat of flexible nuclear responses? And for what purpose? Obviously, to keep aggression out or to deter aggression. But to which extent did NATO want to roll back communism? Or inversely, to which extent did it want simply to coexist with the Soviet bloc? And these questions were always inherently difficult for NATO to sort of give clear answers to. But NATO's success is that they were always able, at the end of the day, to come up with one answer that was a consensus. It wasn't perfect, but it was a consensus. And NATO's consensus was what deterred the Soviet Union, because they saw that there's a common position and it's too strong for us to seriously challenge.
And then we come to the 90s, and you could position it as a period where Russia is more trustworthy. You could equally position it as an era where Russia simply did not have the wealth and the means to project power and coercion, if one was to be cynical about it. In that period of a weak Russia, many countries in Europe who had previously been part of the Warsaw Pact, which I think, it'd be interesting to hear your view on that, I see as a coercive alliance. People did not vote to join it. It was puppet regimes that were forced to do that. NATO obviously doesn't operate in that way, but they chose and they selected to become part of NATO. How important was that for these countries? And how is Russia still able to spin this as expansion when in fact it's an elective process rather than a coercive one?
So that's a big topic, right? But let me begin by the crisis in Russia. We tend to associate it with something that happened when the Soviet Union fell apart, and here out comes Russia and it begins anew. But I tend to say that there's a crisis of state authority and state capacity in the Soviet Union / Russia that begins in the early 80s. At that point, it becomes really clear that the Brezhnev era of stagnation has become a crisis. And it is out of this crisis that Gorbachev emerges to seek deep going reforms, and he fails because it all falls apart. But this sense of crisis in the state lasts through the 80s, through the 90s, and we can only really understand Putin's regime, which takes off in 2000, as a response to this very prolonged state crisis. And he's rebuilding the state, and he's rebuilding the ambitions that the security apparatus of the Soviet Union had, namely to run a powerful state. And the former Warsaw Pact countries in East and Central Europe, they, when Russia was in this crisis of state authority, they were able to choose, they saw that the window is open and we need to choose now, and we need to get under the NATO umbrella now, because you never know, maybe Russia will return to a state capacity and a state outlook that will be threatening to us. And most of them at the time, they thought that this will definitely happen, and in retrospect, they were right. And the deal that NATO and Russia made in 1997, and this is ahead of NATO's enlargement. The deal was that NATO will enlarge, but it will enlarge mostly politically, new members, when we'll talk democracy. But we will weaken NATO militarily, There will be no Western movement of forces or military installations. We will not build up. Instead, NATO was building down militarily. In fact, the bigger NATO became softer, and it was unable to defend itself. And that weakened NATO militarily was what Russia gained. And in return, Russia was supposed to deliver democratic reforms in Russia. But that all fell apart. And what we're seeing today is a very belated reaction in NATO that we left NATO, our own defense alliance, unable to defend itself. And they're busy correcting course.
And this leads to, I think, quite a challenging question, because here on the 75th anniversary, there's a lot of hoopla, you know, celebrating NATO and its success. But Article 5, that has been one of the core tenets of that success, the deterrence of invasions of member states, there is at least a suspicion at this point that Article 5 is under threat from a number of directions, and possibly at least some doubt in the minds of Russians that we have the will and capacity to enforce it. It depends, of course, what that incursion would look like. You know, if they were to take big chunks of Lapland, are we going to initiate the Third World War? Are we going to enact Article 5 for that? If they were to roll over the Balkans, the Baltic states rather, in a couple of days, would we launch World War III based on Article 5 for that? It seems that so many red lines have been tripped in the last couple of years. Now we are seeing chemical weapons potentially in use right across the front line. There are reports coming in this week of extensive chemical weapons use, and Putin attacking energy infrastructure in Ukraine on a massive scale. These are all extraordinary war crimes, which we have threatened would elicit a response, and there is no response forthcoming. We have the so-called Havana syndrome. We have the Baltic jammer going on now several months. We have missiles flying over NATO states, albeit temporarily, and there is no significant response to that. Are we giving out signals that actually maybe Article 5 has lost its teeth as well?
I think NATO is pretty clear, and I would agree on this, that NATO is supposed to deter and defend and deter against Russian aggression against the territories of the NATO allies. And what we're seeing from Russia is intimidation, and they're testing the waters. And what is key for NATO under these circumstances is to be very firm and again, uphold consensus that they will not tolerate any sort of Russian intimidation. And again, it's the consensus that deters. And of course, what they have come to realize is that a political consensus needs military means, and they're ramping up on the means. But the fact that Finland and Sweden have joined makes them stronger in some of these flank theaters where they were previously quite exposed, especially in the Baltics. But it's clear that Russia is trying to poke at NATO and see whether challenges below the threshold of armed aggression can provide openings into NATO where they can sow discord. And some of it is information warfare, some of it is minority politics, and some of it is just pure and simple intimidation, or buying off politicians and having them say odd things. And again, if they succeed in creating fractures in NATO, that will be a major victory for them. And this is why it has always been sacrosanct for Western politicians that, you know, whatever happens, whatever comes, then they have to say that NATO is something we stand firmly behind, whatever happens. And the reason why President Trump was such an outlier in this is that he said, you know, maybe not whatever happens. Maybe I won't defend allies who don't pay much into a defense budget. He made NATO's pledge of solidarity contingent. And that is an open door for Russian continued meddling. And we have seen candidate Trump now for the 2024 elections do it, say the exact same thing. It's these type of contingency, political contingency, that maybe we won't defend each other. This is what Russia is looking for.
And how likely do you think is it that there may be some kind of provocation? Certainly there'll be further testing, but a provocation, let's say in the Suwalki corridor, or in a Baltic state, or some, under-inhabited part of Lapland. What are the chances that Russia will keep pushing harder and harder on this? Or are there softer flanks for them to continue their forever war? For instance, Central Asia, Armenia, Moldova, territories that are not covered by the Article 5 umbrella.
Well, I keep being slightly surprised by Russia, so I have to give it to them for their imagination is rich. And one of the things I imagine that they will keep doing is cultivate Turkey as a NATO ally that has one foot in each camp. So Turkey is really not with the NATO consensus on the war in Ukraine. And Russia will continue to work on this. Another thing we might see coming is more refugee flows, and that could come out of Kaliningrad, and that would severely test the Nordic Scandinavian states if they suddenly face refugee flows sailing out of Kaliningrad on small dinghies. I think we should just be prepared to be agile and maintain very solid channels of consultation, again, because it's consultation that will give consensus.
And when it comes to the topic of rearming, so of course you've got consensus, but at this point we're entering a much hotter phase, hotter perhaps than any point in the Cold War, because you've got Western armaments, you've got Storm Shadow, Scalp, you've got Leopards on the ground that are taking Russian lives. So it's far more direct confrontation perhaps than at any point in the Cold War. But at the same time, are we rearming fast enough? Are we taking that at all seriously? And how important is it that we do, in order to maintain the deterrence effect?
So European allies are certainly not rearming fast enough. They have been depleting their stocks to help Ukraine, and they have now depleted them to a point where they think it becomes too risky for themselves to deplete them further, because they would like to have something in store if something goes if the balloon goes up for NATO. And so they have, in a way, spent wasted 2 years of war in Ukraine, not getting their own defense industry off the ground. And now they're now in a hurry. They're realizing this also with the possibility that America could change policy on NATO for good, and perhaps in a way leave collective defense to the Europeans themselves. And so there's a realization that they have really been on a vacation, and they've been slow to wake up. But they could choose to say, we will deplete our own stocks even further, because the main event in Europe is the war in Ukraine. So we should help Ukraine even further, and then simultaneously accelerate the buildup of their own defense industries. This is possible, but it takes political will, and it's only emerging as we speak.
And of course, there now seems to be crystallized a, I think, a fundamental difference of strategy and a difference of perception. You have Britain and France, and of course, Nordics and Baltics, who do not seem limited in their thinking by, let's say, escalation management, I think it's been called. I'm starting to think that it's something sort of something slightly more insidious than that. But in Berlin and Washington, you have this incredible fear, I believe, of nuclear escalation. And of course, Russian propaganda, Russian psyops really do sort of play on this heavily, this nuclear terrorism to get what they want and to limit Western support for Ukraine. That is now having a devastating effect. And it's not just the GOP blocking supplies. It's clear that a drip feed of munitions from the US, quite possibly from the very start of full-scale war, is based on a hugely successful strategy by Russia to threaten and coerce and create this illusion that if you supply too much too fast, it's World War III, it's this, it's the apocalypse. Britain and France don't seem to be quite so coerced by this, and through the provision of Storm Shadow and Scalp and what's been achieved by those, they've kind of shown that a lot of those threats are empty and hollow. But this gap seems to be opening up. How does NATO, if at all, cope with that, and how does it move forward?
Well, it's obviously an ongoing debate in NATO, and collectively, the Allies made the mistake early on to say that, in very clear terms, that NATO would not be a part of this war. This was not a war involving NATO, and clearly, that was de-escalatory. They wanted things to be kept under control. But that was also to say, and this is how the Russians rightly understood it, that there was a fear of escalation in the West. And so the West self-deterred, and the Russians, they knew this is something we can exploit. And the Western countries have been slow to wake up to this and respond to this. And I think you quite rightly point out that the United States and Germany, they continue to hold back. France is a newcomer to this, and they have Macron's France has gone from being soft on Russia to now being tough on Russia. The problem in that is that it is not quite credible from the perspective of East European allies. Should we trust France? Yesterday they said one thing, today they say another thing. And Britain is where Britain is, and it cannot pull the entire NATO train on its own. So we're, in many ways, we're stuck with the US again. And I have consistently thought that the Biden administration's approach to the war was very strong on political rhetoric and moral condemnation of Russia's choice of war, but medium to soft on the type of weapons they delivered to Ukraine. And as if they were thinking in earnest that this is about making Russia bleed, but not Ukraine win. And clearly, Russia has proven more resilient than that. And they're now hesitating to ramp up their assistance to Ukraine. And Germany is, as always, one step behind the United States, and they are not going to step out front.
And we see that with the non-provision of Taurus, and indeed we see that with the contracts for producing more Taurus missiles lapsing. Again, it gives a strong signal to Russia that there are certain things we won't do, and there are certain, let's say, actions that Ukraine could take to edge closer towards victory that we will not enable. That leads to the question, is there a concept of victory? Because if you speak to any Ukrainian, they almost universally will be able to define what victory means. It means the recovery of their sovereign territories. It means the populations, who essentially the majority of them are hostages, held by Russia in sort of lawless and horrific conditions within the occupied territories. It means return of the children, the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of their population who not only have been forced to leave, but many are undergoing, dare I say it, sort of rehabilitation camps with mental and even physical torture. There are many cases of that now, and we see use of rape and other tools, torture, rape, and innumerable war crimes being committed as Russia tries to exert its will. I mean, where do we go from here? Russia seems to be able to act with absolute impunity, and Ukraine's concept of victory is not shared clearly by some of the Western allies.
So NATO does not have a concept of victory because they have always the Allies have always defined NATO's role as a supportive one, and even in the second line of support, where the primary line of support has been individual countries, NATO countries, but also non-NATO countries acting in coalition to support Ukraine, and NATO has been behind that coalition. In a way, you could say that the steering group of the coalition has been the United States and then the G7 countries, the big economies gathered in G7. NATO has been not very present. And what we see now, and this might this sort of to answer your question as well on the concept of victory, NATO is now stepping forward with the proposal that NATO should take the lead on ensuring that there will be sufficient funds and there will be coherent thinking in channeling a significant military aid that is actually of use to the Ukrainians. So not too many weapon systems, not things that are impossible for them to maintain because there are too many different systems involved. And maintaining it over time as a pathway to NATO membership. So both a military and a political design in one policy. That this is what Secretary General of NATO Jens Stoltenberg has proposed. Now, what is interesting is that he seems to be a little bit ahead of the Allies on this, as certainly the Allied consensus. And so he's trying to shape the consensus ahead of the summit in July of this year in Washington. As a experienced Secretary General who is outgoing, he can do that. He can be a little bit ahead of the Allies, but he cannot be far ahead of the Allies because that will be costly if he fails. So I think we're seeing sort of the contours of the next position of NATO, the next point of consensus, that they will, for a number of years, make sure that Ukraine gets considerable, coherent, and substantial military aid as a pathway to NATO membership. Whether that will be enough, that is the question, because the situation on the ground is not looking good. And as you said, Ukraine has chosen not to fight this war on the ground, but with deep strikes, and they need help to do that.
Indeed. I mean, and they are developing extraordinary drone capabilities. There is, you know, there is, there was rumored for some time to be extreme disquiet on the US side about its strategy in Belgorod, Kursk, and the deep strikes on Russian oil refinery capacity. Essentially, that fuel oil, which powers Russia's war machine, powers the machines of war that are executing Putin's will. That, you know, many of the speakers on the channel will say that is an extraordinary inventive strategy, and it's the first thing in 2 years that have provided a genuine threat to Putin and his ambitions. Very little else, including internal dissent, has been able to, I would think, sort of apart from Prigozhin's mutiny, elicit any kind of sense of threat or anxiety, I think, with Putin. And yet there's this huge disquiet about that. We'll come back to Stoltenberg in a minute because there's the other thing about sort of freezing the lines of contact and what happens to the occupied territories. But does NATO have a position on Ukraine's strategy, which could be classed as sort of unconventional warfare?
I haven't seen NATO have a position on this. I think NATO is as an alliance, so this is the point of consensus, is that they are supporting Ukraine's right of self-defense, and they're building, training the Ukrainian state and its military means for its legitimate self-defense. So we have to remember that NATO is not delivering weapons to Ukraine. These are individual countries doing that, individual allies. NATO has a training mission. It has sort of a state capacity building mission in Ukraine, and they have a dialogue in the NATO Russia NATO Ukraine Council. I'm sorry, and this is about capacity building. We simply do not have a view of there's no consensus in NATO of what victory should look like or how NATO can sort of shape that. But what is clear, and we know this from the individual efforts, is that some allies are comfortable with the Ukrainian choice of deep strike strategy, and some are very uncomfortable with this. And again, that would be Germany and the United States. What I gather, and I gather this also from a visit I had to Kiev in January, the Ukrainian side has a sense that Putin has a vulnerability, and that is his inability to secure the population. And they took note of his reaction to the Progressin revolt in that he disappeared. He became inactive, and he hesitated. And if there's trouble at home, he can be made to look weak. And that is his Achilles heel. And that is what they're striking at with the insurgents moving in with deep strikes and the forced withdrawal of the Black Sea Fleet. This is all about attacking the political center of the country and complicating every line of command in that country and its political will to fight this war to an end.
Indeed, and it's existential for Ukraine if they were to fight in the conventional way, in a way that Berlin and Washington are entirely comfortable with. This quite potentially would be the route to defeat, to annihilation of their language, culture, territory, and all this huge democratic potential that we see coming out of the country. Turning back to Stoltenberg's speech, although it's to be welcomed, the idea that there's a firmer commitment for Ukraine to become part of that security umbrella, that speech did seem to link it to allowing Russia to keep occupied territories, or even to formalize, if I got that right, to formalize that. This would be deeply unacceptable to most Ukrainians, not just because it's about land or resources, but because they understand that there are people there who are essentially hostages of a terroristic regime, and they know what those people are undergoing in that occupation.
Right, and I'm not sure what Stoltenberg's thinking on this really is, and I certainly don't see the alliance in any way accepting the argument that there should now be land for peace. To the contrary, I see a consensus that this war is bigger than just Ukraine. In other words, that Russia's revisionism, the danger of Russia, is considerable, and land for peace cannot work in that situation. But how that pans out, I'm simply unsure. I think, as I said again, Stoltenberg seems to be a little bit ahead of the Allies on this one, and again, I only a seasoned, outgoing Secretary General would do this kind of thing, and my sense is that he's not far ahead of the Allies, but he's clearing probing to see where he can shape a consensus for Washington, and part of it is part of the reason why he's stepping out forward is that he needs to accelerate. Biden is hesitating. Congress is hesitating. Trump may be returning, so he has to be strong or on the offense in terms of securing a NATO deal that can withstand whatever political upheaval the elections in November in the United States will bring.
And can the NATO alliance survive? Can it indeed be provide a credible deterrence if the US was to either withdraw in fact, or as Trump has done. You know, he may not be able to withdraw legally, but he certainly can withdraw in terms of the sort of tone and his rhetoric and that kind of stuff. Can NATO really provide that deterrence without the US, without its material, and without its sort of will to keep that going? And what are the risks if it does not?
NATO without US deterrence will be fundamentally different, and it would introduce a whole new level of risk in Europe. So NATO's engine room has defense and deterrence. And by defense, it's we understand conventional forces that are able to fight at the border and keep the enemy at the gate. Deterrence, we understand nuclear weapons and their ability to punish an enemy that transgresses the frontier. Deterrence is very, very, very much about US extended nuclear deterrence. Europeans can do some defense with US help. And presumably, if the US gave Europeans, you know, in 5 years, we'll help you for 5 years and then we'll be out. Then they could do. They could ramp up on the defense. They could have some combat support, the help from the US, and perhaps there could be a level of defense that we could live with. The key problem that would make it all unravel is the lack of nuclear deterrence. That great big stick of punishment, if an aggressor really goes all out in attacking NATO, that stick, if the US does not provide it. There's only Britain with its strategic nuclear weapons and submarines, and there's France. They have both strategic and tactical nuclear weapons. Britain does not have the infrastructure, the weapons to say that we will extend that deterrence to the Baltic states or to Poland. France has no tradition of it. They have always linked their nuclear deterrence to their own territory. They're talking about having a wider conversation on this, but for other countries to feel comfortable that I will stake my survival on the willingness of the French president to launch nuclear weapons, there's a heck of a distance. And so there really is no good option for extended deterrence in Europe. And gradually, would be my prediction, if the US left the alliance, there would be a race for acquiring nuclear weapons. I presume that the Polish would not really feel comfortable telling the Germans, couldn't you build nuclear weapons and then protect us? They would, if they cannot have that protection from the United States, they would probably seek their own nuclear weapons. And so would Ukraine. They will understand that they will not get protection from NATO tomorrow or any time. And so it will be up to them, and they will seek that nuclear deterrent, I think.
And really, another area to focus on, and maybe this is sort of the last or second last question, and this is a question of leadership as well. Do we know who is going to be taking over, and how important is it going to be, or what signal does it give about the future direction of NATO based on who they choose for a leader? I believe, is it Mark Rutte, the of is it a former prime minister of Holland, if I'm, or the Netherlands, if I'm not mistaken, but with a fairly poor track record of investing in the military there. And then we have the extremely hawkish lady from the Baltics, whose name I need to learn how to pronounce that. But of course, her family have been direct victims of Soviet oppression and the hideous, cruel deportations that were carried out under the Soviet Union, very similar to, you know, the current behavior. Shockingly enough, 80 years on, we see the same sort of behaviors now. Is it going to tell us a lot about the direction of NATO and its will to resist Russia based on who they choose to lead it?
Well, I think so. It will be important for NATO to choose a former prime minister, head of government, and not a foreign minister or defense minister, as we used to see from most of the Cold War. or and well into the post-Cold War era, because NATO is in so many ways now dependent on a dialogue between heads of states and governments that the Secretary General needs to be recruited from that family. So that was just for starters. But I think then we should be mindful that NATO's key asset is its political consensus. And you need a Secretary General who can engender consensus. And I think that's the key asset of Mark Rutte from the Netherlands, that he is known for being a good diplomat and someone who makes people feel comfortable, and he creates connections, and he's good at making people come to agreement, and he's neither north or south, or he's neither east or west, and he's a coalition politician. So in many ways, he fits the bill. But of course, that is also to say that with Rutte, it would be NATO acknowledging we have an acute need for someone who can establish consensus. Whereas if they pick someone from who has a more marked profile on Russia as a sort of a warning against Russia, it would be a statement to say that, yes, we can actually say things and mean it, and yet have consensus. We have a profile here, and we stand by it. So it will be interesting to see where they end on this, come out on this.
Would it be crude to put labels on it, like, you know, it's the choice between a diplomat or even managerial skills and the choice between leadership skills? Because it seems to me one of the major problems of the Biden, it's about to call it regime, no, the elected government, Biden's elected government, one of the real problems there seems to be that in the figure of Jake Sullivan, you have someone who is a quintessential manager, not a leadership mentality, extremely cautious. I won't say indecisive, but certainly he's been coerced by Russia into this extreme incrementalism. And any concept of victory is entirely lacking, which seems to me to suggest a lack of leadership skills. Given where we are, given that mismanagement of this situation could easily at this point lead to World War III. Some would even argue that we are already in the early stages of that now. Opting for a manager as opposed to a leader would be to opt for a Chamberlain as opposed to a Churchill.
So obviously that would not be very beneficial to the alliance, but I'm sort of thinking of Stoltenberg versus Rasmussen, who preceded Stoltenberg, the Danish Secretary General. He wanted to be a leader. He wanted to lean forward and drive the alliance towards a greater political engagement with Afghanistan, especially. In being a leader, he also lost some of the alliance behind him. He moved too far out front as a Secretary General. And it was Stoltenberg's task to pick up the pieces in a way and make sure that we have all allies on board, because again, consensus is NATO's key asset. So there's a limit to how much of a leader we can get as a Secretary General. And leadership is coming out of the White House, the White House in the U.S., but you know, the main national capitals. We need, as a Secretary General, someone who's very, very good at reading the room. Where are the capitals? How can I formulate ideas that will help them mobilize and get consensus? So maybe we should call it a managerial leader or a diplomatic leader. There's some sort of hybrid in that role that is absolutely necessary.
And lastly, what are the chances that the incoming Secretary General can get all European countries to at least the sort of 2% commitment to spend on defense, or go beyond that and the sort of 3.89 we're seeing in Poland and in the Baltic countries as well, extremely high? What's the importance of that, and how likely is it that pressure could be brought to bear to deliver upon that. It would seem to be a critical thing. And of course, Britain at the moment is lagging, I would say. The most recent budget has very little. In fact, the army is shrinking, not growing.
Well, the driver of European defense budgets are the war and the prospect that the United States will weaken its alliance ties. Those two are plenty enough to drive European budgets up. So where the Secretary General will make a difference is in getting the southern part of the alliance on board. So Spain, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Turkey, they are high, but for different reasons. And creating a consensus that we spend all this money in a way that it benefits all of us. And again, if the war comes to an end all of a sudden tomorrow, or if Biden gets reelected and Team America becomes pro-European all day long, some of the defense budgets may come to a halt, and then the Secretary General will have to reinvigorate all that and say, well, now we need to prepare for the next crisis, so that the job will become harder. But right now, way it looks, it will not be a problem for the Secretary General to get budgets to rise, but it will be to have the money spent in a way that delivers political military effect for the alliance.
It's been a huge pleasure speaking to you. I strongly advise people to check out your book. I haven't had a chance yet to get my hands on the full copy, so I've been looking at the sort of Kindle version, skimming through that. But it's deeply fascinating, and of course, on the 75th anniversary of NATO, extremely timely that that should come out. But thanks so much for calling us. I know you're in a hotel there, and it's sort of difficult to dial in. So I'm extra appreciative of you spending the time to talk to our audience today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great talking to you. So thanks again.
Thank you.